We dream of roaming the galaxies, traveling at the speed of light.
Warp drive, Mr. Scott.
When in fact, here in the real world, we only just managed to send a robot to Mars.
How in the hell do you get to another star system?
Trust me, they're trying hard to figure that out.
Famously, Thomas Jefferson said in 1812 that it will take 1,000 years for the Republic to reach the ocean, meaning the Pacific. He never envisioned that in 57 years, a train would run all the way to San Francisco.
In this hour of Studio 360, science fiction is driving the efforts of real science, supplying ideas that might become reality, like changing Earth's climate for the better.
Some people think that we're a group of mad scientists that want to play God.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much, much more is all ahead in this special hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today's show is about science fiction. We're going to have spaceships, cool high-tech gizmos, virtual reality, a high-stakes world where everything hangs in the balance unless we try this one crazy idea that might just be crazy enough to work. Actually, that sounds kind of corny, right? Everybody knows that good science fiction is grim. Technology out of control, democracy hopeless, the world a mess. Movies like Blade Runner, The Matrix, Children of Men, and more recently The Hunger Games and Divergent.
It's so easy to make money with a tale that says civilization is garbage, our institutions will never be helpful, your neighbors are all useless sheep who could never be counted on in a crisis.
David Brin is a science fiction writer who thinks we've gotten way too fond of speculative technological bummers.
Now, enjoy a couple of characters running around shooting things and having adventures in the middle of a dystopia.
Dystopias aren't cool? That's pretty much heresy in science fiction. But people are starting to agree with him, such as Neal Stephenson, the author of Cryptonomicon. In his fiction, he tends to explore the dark sides of technology, but then, a couple of years ago, he got a public wake-up call.
I was at a conference sharing a stage with Michael Crow, who's the president of Arizona State University.
Stephenson was complaining, there are no big scientific projects to inspire people these days. The president of Arizona State shot back, you're the one slacking off, and by you, he meant science fiction writers like Neal Stephenson.
I had always kind of imagined that in that chicken and egg relationship that science fiction kind of followed after what the engineers were doing. But Michael insisted that it was that the engineers were ready to go. They had the tools, they had the willingness, and that the science fiction writers were no longer pulling their weight by supplying compelling visions of things for the engineers to build.
And as you were hearing him say that, did you sort of feel, yeah, I'm a bit guilty as charged?
I am guilty as charged. I mean, my best-known books, Snow Crash and The Diamond Age, depict kind of classically cyberpunk visions of the future that most people would recognize as dystopian. So I'm kind of exhibit A
yeah.
of this phenomenon.
From that argument, Neal Stephenson and Michael Crow started the Center for Science and the Imagination at Arizona State. And Stephenson created another group called Project Hieroglyph, which recruits science fiction authors to write more optimistically about the future.
I guess I had never maybe given science fiction writers enough credit as being leaders of innovation. I'm still skeptical that they are.
Right.
And that's essentially what Michael Crow and I were arguing about.
Well, and one could argue, if one were arguing for the other side, that part of the problem is writers reacting to the present moment. You know, there's climate change challenge, the increasing inequality and acceptance of inequality and all the rest. I mean, it's easy to extrapolate the bad to 50 or 100 or 200 years from now.
It takes a lot of work to imagine in a constructive way. And You're almost doing a kind of proto-engineering when you try to design a building or a city or a vehicle of the future that's innovative in some sense. You're not doing real engineering, which is very expensive and requires actual engineers. But
right. You're doing kind of still, a rendering.
Yeah, yeah.
So if some science fiction writer approaches you and says, I want to contribute a story to Project Hieroglyph, what are the rules? Are they required to consult with engineers and scientists like you've done?
They don't have to. We think it's cool if they do, and it suggests that they're on the right track. Writers tend not to do terribly well with rules, so mm-hmm. the general principles we laid down were no hyperspace, no holocausts, and no hackers. That's the third one.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So,
coming from you, that's a real apostasy.
Yeah.
The entertainment industry's got a job to do as well. Commander Chris Hadfield served on the International Space Station. He wants to see movie studios and game designers use their arsenals of special effects to depict fewer explosions and more realism, such as the Oscar-winning film Gravity.
What we do as astronauts all the time is simulate space flight. We practice so that when we actually get to go do it, when you go do a spacewalk or do something complex, you're not numbed or overwhelmed by the difficulties and the complexity, but you've simulated it well. And so I think it may just be almost in the raw visualization capability now of seeing what it's going to look like to walk around on Mars, that you maybe don't have to trip over so many obstacles along the way. That is the real stuff of dreams, and that's where invention comes from.
In this hour of Studio 360, we're talking to writers, designers, scientists who are all trying to imagine a more hopeful future. And not just imagine it, but help make it happen. We'll start at MIT, where a couple of professors are using sci-fi to fire up the imaginations of their students. Julia Lowry Henderson sat in on one of their classes.
MIT's Media Lab is all glass and open floor plans. Everywhere you look, there's an earnest group of people working on something remarkable. Robots here, holograms there. And on Wednesday nights, in a room on the fifth floor, Dan Novi and Sophia Bruckner lead a class called Science Fiction to Science Fabrication.
So we had Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? I'm including Blade Runner, so if you want to list something that you found in Blade Runner that was awesome, that wasn't necessarily from the novel, that counts. Or the Tiptree story, Plugged In Girl.
The week I showed up for class, those were the readings on the table. If you don't know your sci-fi classics, the story Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick is the basis for the movie Blade Runner.
I'm Deckard, Blade Runner, 260-354.
They started class with a conversation about the technologies from those readings that caught people's attention. Sophia went first.
Oh, well, I definitely love the empathy box. It's my favorite. One of my favorite devices from sci-fi of all time.
I really like the mood organ and how you can basically dial yourself the desire to dial yourself. I thought it was really interesting.
I also like the electric sheep.
The class discussion goes all over the place. Talking about Philip K. Dick and James Tiptree took us from nuclear cars powered by thorium.
It's like an El Camino
with a nuclear reactor in the back. I was like, whoa.
To this YouTube video of an artificial intelligence experiment where these two robots get into an existential argument with each other.
I've answered all your questions.
No, you haven't.
What is God to you?
Not everything.
Not everything could also be something.
Then they spend some time doing concept sketches of one of those devices from their readings.
So I started doing something with wires. This version, it actually dispenses your mood into a shot glass.
So I designed an electric sheep. Obviously, it's going to have to interact with people, so it's going to have micro fluffy feelers.
Over the course of the semester, these students, they're supposed to go make some of these things. Well, not the nuclear car, I hope. One of the most promising sketches this week came from Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The key to the book is something called the Voight-Kampff test. It's how you tell a human from an android. You test their empathy.
Is this to be an empathy test? capillary dilation of the so-called blush response, fluctuation of the pupil, involuntary dilation of the iris.
We call it Voight-Kampff for short.
So I was thinking about the Voight-Kampff test. I was imagining a couple of components to it here. He talks about like setting up a camera with a like to look at their eye. And they
That's Greg Borenstein. With 15 minutes and a Sharpie, he had a detailed concept for a working machine.
Also, if you did like an LED on the surface of the skin to light up the veins under the surface, mm-hmm. and like a small but very high frame rate camera right on the surface of the skin, I can imagine you could do some
capillary flush response.
Type of stuff. So I was imagining that hooked up with USB to software and like a display of like the subdermal veins for flush response. I'm looking for like really small scale dilation.
This guy's really good.
And so I was imagining that cheek patch that it is part of what they attach to have both like a GSR sensor on there with an Arduino.
This is just the concept stage. But Greg showed me a project he had already completed for the class, based on the William Gibson novel Neuromancer. It's a video game that lets you take on the action of the book's characters, Case and Molly.
It's a game for two people. One plays as Case, one plays as Molly.
Mm-hmm.
And the Case player is wearing an Oculus Rift, which is a VR headset that tracks your head and lets you kind of immerse yourself in a 3D computer graphics world. And the other person, who plays as Molly, carries two phones with them. And Case has to navigate Molly through a series of physical obstacles.
Okay, so do I want to go right into campus, or do I want to go left?
And using those two phones that Molly's carrying, Case sees in 3D her point of view.
Right here?
It's a little hard to follow. The game is meant to disorient you. There's a video of it up at studio360.org. But playing Greg's game dramatizes how technology disconnects us from the physical world. Greg signed up for this class because he's an avid sci-fi fan. But when he saw the syllabus, he worried about the whole premise here.
The call to action in the class being like, let's read the science fiction and then go build this stuff, is funny when you read the science fiction and it's actively questioning, you know, what that would mean. Is it good?
In other words, Philip K. Dick wasn't saying, let's build empathy boxes. He's imagining a world where we had them. How would we use them or misuse them?
I think that's led to a really interesting tension in the projects in the class where if you approach it from a pure design, oh, I want to be inspired by this way of improving current technology, you can kind of run into weird dead ends. Whereas if you can use making as almost as its own kind of science fiction to imagine what the world will be like, that's almost a better way of emulating the books that we're reading.
And that's what Sophia Bruckner and Dan Novi, who run the class, want. In fact, it's kind of the point.
Reading science fiction is kind of like ethics class for inventors.
With the ability of any technology or any application really to go viral over the planet in 24 hours, I think it is even more important then to think about what you're doing before you release it into the wild.
At a place like MIT, the question has always been, how do we build this? But in this class, they're using science fiction to try to ask a different question. Should we? For Studio 360, I'm Julia Lowry Henderson.
Coming up, a group of scientists set out to design a real-life starship and gave themselves a deadline.
Because if you said 10 years, you say, nah, that's not long enough. We know that's not long enough. If you said 500 years, people say, you know, I can kick back for another, you know, 200 to 300 years because I don't have to worry about it. But a 100 years is close enough in terms of a time frame that we can sort of see it.
That's only minutes away in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. In today's show, we're talking about how science fiction influences the future, the real future we and our children and grandchildren are going to be living in. Now, I can't think of any video game franchise that has lasted as long as SimCity, a quarter of a century since the first version. It's unusual in other ways, too, because it's not about shooting bad guys or blowing stuff up or even really competing. In SimCity, you play the role of mayor cum urban designer. You create your city from scratch, populated by simulated people, the Sims. The latest version, the seventh reinvention of the game, takes a sci-fi turn.
And we were looking at the near future, so sort of 50 to 75 to 100 years in the future.
Jason Haber is one of the designers of SimCity, Cities of Tomorrow. The futuristic tech in the game is based on actual ideas in development. So instead of hoverboards, you get sewage sanitizers, very advanced sewage sanitizers.
The idea of the sewage sanitizer is it takes in the waste from the city and it'll, you know, use its magical technology in SimCity, which we don't need to define, and turn it into clean drinking water. And it just, you know, I look at technology like that and I look at the drought that's happening in California right now and see, you know, we're going to go there. That's going to become more commonplace. And at some point in the future, it's just going to be accepted that, like, oh, yeah, you just sanitize the sewage and then you have more drinking water. We have what we call a maglev train. It's sort of like a magnetic monorail that goes around the city. And that's definitely reminiscent of, like, the Hyperloop that Elon Musk was working on. One of the things you can unlock is a drone system. And you have these drones that will fly over the roads so they don't get stuck in traffic. And when your residents want to go shopping, they'll just send out a drone. It'll go over to a commercial building. It'll pick up the goods and bring it back. And what's interesting is, you know, about a month after we launched the game, Amazon announced their Prime Air, their drone system that's going to do exactly that.
As mayor in the game, you've got to choose between two different paths in this version of SimCity. You can anchor your city around a private company called OmegaCo, which cranks out cheap products and pollutes the environment. They sound Dr. Evil-ish, but they're really more of a necessary evil, the kind we live with and accommodate all the time in real life.
All of a sudden, you're like, well, I have to have OmegaCo in my city or it'll fall apart.
Or you can build your city around the Academy, a hub of green innovation. Or you can mix and match.
And I think green tech is sort of something that's hot right now, so it's really easy to see it and see where it could go. I mean, it was interesting because the dystopian future was actually more difficult to craft for us, to figure out what it would look like. Nobody's striving to be like, I'm going to be the most dystopian technology that's ever been created.
But guess which version of an urban future has been more popular with gamers?
I thought that more people would go after sort of the green, clean technology first, but most people actually go after the OmegaCo dystopian future first. And I think that just shows you the nature of what it's like to play a game and be able to have that fun space to play with. I think working on a game like SimCity, it's interesting because especially when I'm deep in the development of the game SimCity, I can look out the window when I'm flying in a plane and it's like everywhere I look, I see SimCity. I see these buildings. And I'm like, oh, that reminds me of our game. And when I have those moments that I'm like, we're doing something right.
Jason Haber is one of the lead designers of SimCity, Cities of Tomorrow. When we talk about using current technology to influence the future, there's nothing more controversial than geoengineering, trying to tweak the Earth's climate to adjust it to our needs. The author Kim Stanley Robinson says the idea was first used in a 1928 science fiction novel called Terraforming Earth.
Ever since then, it's been something in science fiction's vocabulary, and it was picked up, and it was a crucial moment when Carl Sagan got interested in the idea around 1970 from his studies of the atmosphere of Venus. And he began to speculate that Mars is like the perfect terraforming candidate, that it has a lot of water, and that it's close enough to the sun that if you got a greenhouse effect going on Mars, you might be able to pump up the atmosphere there and melt the ice that's there into water and make a viable human landscape on Mars.
terraforming the Earth or geoengineering the climate used to be the stuff of fiction. But as the reality of global warming sinks in, scientists and other thinkers are debating these ideas seriously. Kim Stanley Robinson took it up 20 years ago in a novel of his about scientists who try to make Mars habitable. But in his story, there's an awful lot of bickering about how to do it and how far they should go.
There are a good many scientists from Arms Corps and Consolidated, as well as Subarashi, who either claim that scrubbing CO2 would not be difficult, or that a CO2-heavy atmosphere would not be so bad. An ecosystem of mostly plants, with CO2-tolerant insects, and perhaps some genetically engineered animals, would flourish in the warm, thick air. And people could walk around in their shirt sleeves with nothing more cumbersome than a face mask. This set Sachs's teeth on edge, and happily he was not the only one. So he could stay in the sea while other people rose to their feet to challenge this fundamental shift in the goal of terraforming. It's not a jungle planet we're after here. You're making a hidden assumption that people can be genetically engineered to tolerate higher CO2 levels, but it's ridiculous. Very soon it became clear that they were accomplishing nothing. No one was really listening, and everyone had their opinions, which were tightly aligned to their employer's interests. It was unseemly, really.
In real-life geoengineering, Trudy Strolmo is an atmospheric scientist at Yale who studies cirrus clouds. Cirrus are the thin, wispy clouds, and they warm the atmosphere by trapping heat. One of the big ideas she's studying is to seed those clouds with ice crystals, which would cause the clouds to become thinner and disappear.
You actually have to get the amount of seeding right. So if you don't put enough of these so-called seeding particles up into the upper atmosphere, you would get no effect at all. But if you put too much, you could actually have the opposite effect of the desired. You could actually cause a warming rather than a cooling, which would be obviously disastrous. I will add, though, that if this were ever implemented, we would very carefully monitor what was happening, and we could very quickly adjust the amount so that we got it roughly right.
The experts think the cloud seeds wouldn't cause any permanent damage.
They have a very short lifetime in the atmosphere of only a couple of weeks. So whatever you put up there, in a few weeks it will be gone. But when you put things higher up, there are no clouds and precipitation, so the particles can stay up much, much longer. And so a typical lifetime in the stratosphere would be 5 to 10 years. And so whatever you put up there, you're stuck with for a while.
She's referring here to a different plan, first proposed in 1983 and still being studied, to spread sulfur dioxide particles around the planet.
You can think of them as tiny mirrors that would reflect sunlight back to space.
Those particles are meant to simulate what happens after a volcanic eruption.
A classical example is the Mount Pinatubo eruption of 1991, which is thought to have cooled Earth's climate by about half a degree centigrade for a few years. So in a way, Earth has sort of gone through this experiment itself already and tested some of the effects of it.
That one scares people to death.
Again, the author Kim Stanley Robinson.
One of the things that people immediately point out, and it's very important to point this out, is this is a bad solution long term, because if we keep on making CO2 and just try to bounce sunlight away and think we've accomplished the trick, we've ignored the fact that the CO2, a third of it approximately, lands in the oceans. And if you acidify the oceans, a lot of the littlest creatures with calcium shells might die off. And at that point, when the bottom of the food chain dies off, everything else in the food chain dies off, and we get what they call the jellypocalypse, the jellyfish only in the oceans. A superbly bad disaster.
Some people think that we're a group of mad scientists that want to, you know, play God. I think that most people I know who are working on geoengineering, most scientists want to be very, very cautious. They take the position that they want to study and inform. And so far, you know, very few scientists get into the role of making recommendations and trying to affect policy in any way.
But proposing what's possible will inevitably shape the agenda.
Particularly if some of these geoengineering mechanisms turn out to not be very expensive to implement, you can worry that individual states can simply go ahead and implement geoengineering. Maybe particularly if they feel like they are suffering more than the rest of the globe And even individuals, wealthy individuals, you can imagine that they could simply decide that they wanted to do something about global warming and go ahead with geoengineering.
In his novel 2312, Kim Stanley Robinson imagines that in the future, people refer to our times here in the early 21st century as the dithering, because we're so bogged down by denial and indecision. He thinks we will become desperate enough to try technological fixes. For the record, though, he'd prefer we go after greenhouse gases at the source. You know, power plants, cars and trucks, us.
Social justice is geoengineering. And in general, like income equality, it's the case that the worst damage to this planet is done by the richest people and the poorest people. Mm. The richest people by hyperconsumption and the poorest people by deforestation and topsoil loss, because they have to try to feed their family that night. They cut down trees. They wreck their soil doing bad ag practices trying to stay alive. So the richest and the poorest are the worst impact on the environment.
And by the rich, we mean you and me and everybody else in America, not just the rich people in America.
Right. Well, U.S. citizens as a whole are like 25% of the environment, of the carbon burn on this planet, even though we're only 5% of the population.
Right.
So, yes, you could make a quick division and say that of the 7 billion people, the top billion and the bottom billion in terms of individual income are the big hammers.
Dramatically tinkering with the Earth's atmosphere or dramatically tinkering with wealth distribution? I'm not sure which sounds more like pie-in-the-sky science fiction. I'm Kurt Anderson, and in this hour of Studio 360, we're talking about how science fiction shapes the world we live in, now and in the future. A lot of people involved in space travel have been depressed the last few years about the lack of public and government support for manned space travel. But a number of smaller enterprises and big thinkers like Stephen Hawking want to work around NASA and figure out how, if ever, we'll get to other solar systems. We sent Anne Hepperman to see if they're making any progress.
Talking about building a spaceship that goes to the stars makes you sound like a bit of a nut job. Unless you're a former astronaut, like Dr. Mae Jemison, then you're allowed to ask,
how in the hell do you get to another star system?
3, 2, 1, and liftoff.
And this is a very real question for Dr. Mae Jemison. She heads up 100-Year Starship. It's an independent organization whose mission is to figure out how to get to Alpha Centauri, our closest star, by 2114.
That time frame is reasonable. Why? Because if you said 10 years, you say, nah, that's not long enough. We know that's not long enough. If you said 500 years, people say, you know, I can kick back for another, you know, 200 to 300 years, because I don't have to worry about it. But a 100 years is close enough in terms of a time frame that we can sort of see it.
And there are hurdles when it comes to interstellar travel, like the fact that space is just so damn big.
Just making the jump from interplanetary to interstellar or transgalactic is about as much as my mind could wrap around now.
Mark Millis is the head of the Tau Zero Foundation, another interstellar organization. Millis worked at NASA for 30 years as a physicist and aerospace engineer.
If you're traveling with technology that we can already conceive, like, say, the Voyager spacecraft.
10 seconds to SRB jet.
It's going to take about 80,000 years to travel a distance to our nearest neighboring star. And it is going 0.00006 times the speed of light.
Vehicle is now traveling at 4,900 miles per hour.
And Voyager is the fastest thing that we've got. Current spacecraft relies on fueled rockets to get them from point A to point B. Nuclear rockets, that's fission and fusion, are tricky because no one wants to risk one of them blowing up during liftoff. So Millis says, we need to figure out a way to get to the stars without rockets. Space drives is what he calls them.
Well, strap yourselves in. I'm going to make a jump to light speed.
He gave a talk last year at the Icarus Interstellar Starship Conference. It's called From Sci-Fi to Sci-Method, a Case Study in Space Drives.
So I'm first going to play with some notions, you know, the kind of questions you would ask if watching science fiction. And for example, here we have Luke's land speeder, which is somehow magically levitating.
Millis believes that science fiction can be upgraded to scientific inquiry.
And two, what would happen as it's cruising along if there's objects in the way? Well,
he's not interested in how to build Luke's land speeder. He wants to put himself in the imaginary space where a land speeder can exist.
When it was parked, it did not move. So whatever magic was levitating it also had the ability to keep it in place laterally, which would mean that it would have the power to move it laterally. So, okay, so you have some sort of magic that can change its speed.
Some sort of magic. That's how far scientists are willing to go in trying to imagine what's possible. Because we'll never reach the stars without magic. In other words, a breakthrough in physics that we absolutely can't see coming.
Howdy, Anne.
Who is that?
German accent, you want?
James and Gregory Benford are the head of another interstellar organization, Starship Century. You're both physicists, right?
Right.
And they're also identical twins. James is president of a company that does microwave research. Gregory is an astrophysicist at UC Irvine and a renowned sci-fi author. The Benford brothers are optimists. Gregory likes to point out how much we sometimes underestimate the pace of change.
Famously, Thomas Jefferson said in 1812 that it will take 1,000 years for the Republic to reach the ocean, meaning the Pacific. And he never envisioned that in 57 years, a train would run all the way to San Francisco.
The Benford brothers say they've figured out a way to get us to the stars in 100 years. Beam sails. Beam sails are sort of like regular sails, but without wind.
Envision it as a giant umbrella, maybe 100 meters across.
And you push it using microwave beams.
And therefore, you can push it to very high speeds. And that is the core idea.
And James says, these sails come right out of science fiction.
Roche World, written by Robert Forward back in the 80s, based on a very solid scientific concept for a starship, which we actually know how to build.
Robert Forward was a physicist and aerospace engineer. His book, Roche World, contained detailed descriptions of beam sails that the Benford brothers used as inspiration for their breakthrough experiment in 2001. Their goal was to make a beam sail fly. Gregory remembers setting up the experiment and then almost missing the breakthrough.
We saw it in one frame just lifting off, and then the next frame it was gone. It had, in fact, literally stuck itself to the ceiling of the container.
They were ecstatic.
Because it was the first time anyone had lifted an object against gravity with just electromagnetic power.
I went outside the building and dialed up Bob Forward on my cell phone and told him we'd done it. He only lived another year or two, but he saw it become real.
The Benfords are really optimistic about this. But so far, beam sails have only been tested in the lab. There's a lot of experiments to be done on Earth and in space before we know if they can power a starship. Even Mae Jemison, the astronaut who runs 100-year Starship, admits that the 100-year estimate is kind of a tease.
We're not going to launch anything in 100 years, but there needed to be a time frame that was reasonable to expect that you might make some of these capabilities exist.
But Jemison is confident that one day we will have manned interstellar travel, so we'll have to figure out more than just the physics.
That is culture. Human behavior is going to be a part of, literally, what culture do you take with you? What is your identity?
When NASA launched Voyager in 1977, it included the Golden Record, a time capsule of sounds from Earth. But what happens when you send a group of people across galaxies to stand in for all of us?
If you're going to send a group of people away for a very, very long time and may not come back, then we have to understand what completes us as humans.
Getting a starship to Alpha Centauri seems like a fantasy. But 100 years ago, we were just getting airplanes right. The 22nd century is a long way from now.
And I don't think I'll live to see it, but my grandchildren will.
You know, Thomas Jefferson didn't get to see California either.
For Studio 360, I'm Ann Hepperman.
Do you want to see the starships of the future? Of course you do. We've got some artist renderings at studio360.org. Coming up, Hollywood always wants scientists to explain everything, even vampires.
And he said it has to be something really goofy and really just something so common, like apple juice. And I thought, what else in the world lives forever? Twinkies.
That is just ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In today's show, we're looking at how science fiction influences real science and the real world. Hollywood's got a thing for scientists, not actual scientists doing actual science, but, say, Natalie Portman in the movie Thor.
Look, the lensing around these edges is characteristic of an Einstein-Rosen bridge.
A what?
An Einstein-Rosen bridge is a theoretical connection between two different points of space-time.
The wormhole.
Some of that is real jargon written by scientists consulting for the filmmakers. There's even a thing called the Science and Entertainment Exchange. So let's say you're a movie director and you need some physics in your movie. You could call up the exchange and they might refer you to Kevin Grazier. He spent 15 years as a planetary physicist at NASA.
I've worked on Battlestar Galactica. I worked on the film Gravity. I've worked on Eureka, Defiance, Falling Skies. Those are the big ones.
Or you might need somebody like Jessica Kale, whose specialty is in biological psychology. She teaches at Pepperdine University. Kale has consulted on movies such as 13 Sins, and she's also helped explain the Hulk's brain for a touring exhibit about the Avengers.
Our job as consultants isn't to rewrite their script into a doctoral dissertation. Our job is to take what they want to happen and make it, if not perfectly scientifically accurate, at least as plausible as possible.
You are grounding the story in the natural world, in the familiar, to prevent your audience from leaping into what are called the oh please moments. The oh please moments occur when you get something wrong. Usually when you get something wrong, you don't have to get wrong. And the audience knows that it's wrong, and instead of being immersed in your narrative, they sit back and say, oh, please.
The things I've consulted on have been mostly things that are in the addiction or brain fields. One of the more fun ones I consulted on was where some sort of dark agency called and said,
hello?
Congratulations. You have been selected to take part in a one-of-a-kind game show.
If you kill that fly, $1,000 will be wired into your bank account immediately.
All you have to do is complete 13 challenges. Swat the fly.
You're watching me now?
He does it, and his bank account goes up instantly. You can see it all on his smartphone. And then they just keep raising the stakes 13 times total until the point where it gets really dangerous and crazy. And at some point, it's not even for the finances anymore. It's for the addictive property of the action.
Eureka ran for 5 seasons on the Sci-Fi Channel. Eureka is a town where brilliant people do the most advanced science on the planet. And sometimes advanced science goes a little bit wonky.
Henry, where the hell have you been? I'll put you on speaker.
Meeting an old friend. What's happening?
Well, the good news is we moved all the bisecting tunnels into one, so Eureka's not going to go Swiss cheese.
But the subnuclear stresses are building to a critical level. They won't hold for long.
You have to stabilize the strong forces or the tunnel will tear Eureka apart on a gluon level.
Before every season, I would go in and do a PowerPoint presentation of here is promising new technology that we might be able to craft a story from. And then I would always get the scripts, the various incarnations of the scripts to give notes on. From time to time, I actually got calls from Vancouver where we filmed saying, hey, our talent wants to know, is it Hadron or Hadron?
Come on, Han. Time to encase you in carbonite.
Oh, he's only kidding. Actually, we're going to insert a bioabsorbable stent made of pyrolactic acid into your bloodstream and then hook you up to a giant hive mind.
In 2 instances, I had to write partial chapters of books because since we filmed in high definition, when a character opens a book, if you zoom in, you can read it. So what they needed was a chapter of a book or a partial chapter of a book so that when our character opens it, the text is correct. It is not copyrighted,
and it makes sense for what's going on, or compared to what that book is supposed to be.
My husband actually was making a film, is working on it in post-production now, called The Hunted. It's an action comedy, kind of a Buffy meets Cops vampire slaying ride along. It's very goofy, but he needed some scientific plausibility for vampirism. I came up with this whole intricate thing where rabies is a virus that infects mammals' brains, and the way it spreads itself is it goes to the parts of the brain that cause aggression, inducing the urge to bite. Well, there's a perfect parallel for vampirism.
This document, so helpfully provided us by the Red Cross, shows the name and location of every human that has been bitten.
From that point on, he wanted a cure for vampirism, and he said it has to be something really goofy and really just something so common, like apple juice. And I thought, what else in the world lives forever? Twinkies. Twinkies. You cannot kill a Twinkie. They'll live through a nuclear apocalypse. So I thought, what if, much like growing bread mold on bread becomes penicillin, what if you could grow mold on a Twinkie? Would that kill a vampire? Because anything that can kill a Twinkie would obviously kill an immortal.
I think being a scientist, I'm going to use a colloquial term here. When we talk about right and left brain as the analytic versus the creative side, the job of a scientist is, I think, far more right-brained than most people think. Because if you are a working scientist, you're always at the edge of what's known, and what if is a big portion of your life. So you entertain a lot of what if ideas, most of which aren't going to be correct. That is not significantly different than the job of a science advisor.
You know, a lot of science that's out there today started out as science fiction. I mean, one of the new smartphones out there right now does your blood oxygen levels by holding your finger over the flash, and it can tell you how oxygenated your blood is, completely based on tricorders from Star Trek and completely fictional until someone said, I think I can do that in real life. So, you know, I just consider my job to make it plausible, and maybe somebody will make it actual someday.
Hey, hello, I'm reading, Captain. Asthma, 93 degrees, range 1570 yards.
Jessica Kale and Kevin Grazier, scientists who advise the entertainment industry. Our story was produced by Darby Maloney, the arts and entertainment editor at KPCC in Los Angeles. This hour, we've been looking at how today's science fiction may shape our future. We've covered a few of the angles, but I know there are lots of other stories out there. And if you know them, we'd love to hear from you, and maybe we'll get your story on the air. Leave us a comment at studio360.org. And while you're there at the website, you can find all the stories from our long-running series on science and creativity. But to close this show today, we've got writer and performer Carl Hancock Rux, who looks back to the early days of science fiction to see how African-American writers have used the genre to imagine things that seemed impossible.
Who is the black science fiction writer? What is he thinking? What is he imagining? Think of it like this. Remember Alice falling down a rabbit hole, considering the caterpillar's question? Who were you? Who are you now? Who do you want to be? For writers of African descent, science fiction has offered a unique place to try out something unthinkable in realistic fiction, an end to America's tortured history with race. George Schuyler, in the Harlem Renaissance, introduced a mad doctor with a potion to turn black people into white people. Black No More was the title of this satire. But for others, an end to race could only result from some kind of apocalypse. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a short story about this, The Comet, published in 1920. A black man and a white woman are the last people after a comet strikes the Earth. Will they overcome the taboo against miscegenation to save humanity? Perhaps the very first work of black science fiction was a Last Man dystopian novel. M.P. Shields' The Purple Cloud from 1901 was praised by H.G. Wells and H.P. Lovecraft. Shields was of Irish and African descent, and he writes that his protagonist, Adam Jeffson, is a man tortured by race. Jeffson is trying to decide what to do with his life. Should he be a scientist, a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, an artist? He lives at a time when all the world is excited about polar exploration. But he comes upon a preacher giving a warning. What he said was this:
that there was undoubtedly some sort of fate or doom connected with the poles of the earth in reference to the human race, that man's continued failure, in spite of continual efforts to reach them, abundantly and superabundantly proved this, and that this failure constituted a lesson and a warning, which the race disregarded at its peril.
This is a few years before Robert Peary and Matthew Henson claimed to reach the North Pole.
The time was now come when man would find it absolutely in his power to stand on that 90th of latitude and plant an impious right foot on the head of the earth, just as it had been given into the absolute power of Adam to stretch an impious right hand and pluck of the fruit of knowledge.
But, said he, his voice pealing now into one long proclamation of awful augury,
just as the abuse of that power had been followed in one case by catastrophe swift and universal, so in the other,
he warned
the entire race to look out thenceforth for nothing from God but a lowering sky and thundery weather.
Adam is not enlightened by this doctrine. He sets out to join an expedition to the North Pole aboard a high-tech ship powered by a liquid gas. Adam reaches the pole, but the preacher's augury proves true. When he gets back to camp, he finds a purple gas with a peach-like odor that has wiped out the base. The gas destroys all life before it, everyone but him. Traveling the world on his ship, finding nothing but death, Adam goes mad, burning down the great capitals of the world. Finally, he finds a survivor, a young woman in Turkey, and comes to love her. They will have children, he says. For Adam is not only the last man on earth, but the first man on earth. He will begin the human race again. This time, without race.
That's Carl Hancock Rux with his original essay that included excerpts from The Purple Cloud by M.P. Shiel. Music was by Rux and Daniel Bernard Rumain. The Street Preacher was played by Reg E. Cathy. The Droids. It's by Nico Case and Kelly Hogan, and it's on the new comedy album 2776, which is a benefit for the nonprofit One Kid, One World. You can see the video at studio360.org.
Where's that Shackleton?
these real life drums. Hey, we love a Wookiee, but I mean, come on, it's way past time for revolution to your hairless post-apocalyptic constitution.
That is just about it for today's show, but before we go, I want to remind you about our latest Studio 360 Listener Challenge. It's for young writers, writers in high school or just graduated, and we're looking for poems that touch in some way on the idea of summer. The entries have already started coming in. Here are the first few lines of Hazy Summer Days by Amy in Maryland.
The hazy heat waves of summer's end float onto my porch, but as I sit minted in my lawn chair, I notice a certain stillness of the way my dog's chest rises and falls to the melody of bees working in harmony with their blooms.
The poet and professor Dorothea Lasky is the judge for this listener challenge, and you can find out all about it at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Today's program was produced by Eric Malinsky. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Panamaneni,
Jill Duba,
Ariel Roland Waring,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, how a kids' magazine took over American humor.
Excuse me, is this Mad Magazine?
No, it's Mademoiselle. We're buying our sign on the installment plan.
The story of Mad Magazine from our series on American icons. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.